about this job.
We always leave a gap in the show just for your suggestions, and I am regularly amazed by the surprises you throw our way.
New composers, film scores, music for the theatre, and even your own personal stories and connections to the music.
It's the ultimate musical hive mind.
Whatever you're doing, make great music part of your morning.
Essential Classics with me, Georgia Mann.
And me, Tom McKinney. Every weekday from 9 till noon on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3, and now at just after 2 o'clock, it's time for today's early music show, and it's introduced by Lucy Skeeping. Music for Vile Consort, entitled A Song of Robert Parsons. In other words, by Robert Parsons, a composer of real quality who was active during the Tudor period, but who sadly only made it to the tender age of 37. Welcome to the show, and I'm joined in the studio today by Magnus Williamson, Professor of Early Music at Newcastle University, who's going to be my guide throughout today's programme, which is all about Parsons' life and music. Magnus, welcome.
Thank you.
As so often when we're dealing with musicians earlier than the 17th century, Parsons' life story isn't all that easy to pin down. Do we know anything about his early life?
No, there's no certain information at all about his birthplace, where he was educated and his early training. It's almost as if he rose without trace. The first sighting we have is in 1560, when Robert Parsons is asked to collect money from the Exchequer on behalf of Richard Bower, the ageing master of the Children of the Chapel Royal. And this is to help with the children's upkeep. So we can see that Robert Parsons is Bower's assistant at this stage. And by guesswork, if we go backwards from 1560, assuming he's something like 25 years old, it means he's probably born around 1535.
Which is towards the end of Henry VIII's reign, which I guess means he would have begun his musical education in the 1540s. Of course, that was a pretty strange time, wasn't it, in historically speaking, because everything was going on with the religious to-ing and fro-ing.
If you're a church musician, this is a time of bewildering seesawing from one religious policy to another. So in his first 12 years, he's living under Henry VIII. Church music will all be in Latin. There'll be rich polyphony, organ music in worship. And you've got the whole panoply of the old tradition in play. Then as he turns 14 in the late 1540s, the Reformation really begins to bite. The Latin liturgy disappears in the summer of 1549 to be replaced by the first Edwardian prayer book, which ushers out elaborate polyphony and ushers in vernacular worship and some quite serious restrictions on what musicians can do. Fast forward to his 18th birthday, Mary Tudor has come to the throne. The Reformation is thrown into reverse, and worship now is in Latin, and polyphony is encouraged, organ music is encouraged, and all of the old customs that had obtained before 1547 are brought back. And then only 5 years later, when he's in his early to mid-20s, Elizabeth I introduces again the prayer book worship in the vernacular, and the old tradition is extinguished for the final time. This brings us to our first track, which is Parsons' first service. Now, this illustrates perfectly what's going on around 1560 in his mid-20s, because it's in English, it's written for use in church, and so it's written for the prayer book. But it's a very elaborate piece and suits perfectly the tenor and temperament of Elizabeth's Chapel Royal. Elizabeth herself, although supportive of the Protestant religion, was very keen on ritual and ceremony, sometimes to the disapproval of her clergy.
Come, come.
part of Robert Parsons' First Service, a setting of text in English, typical of the pieces being produced at the Chapel Royal to show off the newly restored Protestant religion during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. But Magnus, this wasn't actually Parsons' earliest composition, was it? We don't know where he was or what he was doing in the 1550s, but did he write some Latin church music at that time as well?
Yes, indeed. He wrote quite a quantity of Latin church music, and some of it was composed under Mary Tudor. He would have been approaching his 20s when she came to the throne, and in the previous years, although we don't have any music which you can prove had been written under Edward VI, we can assume that he had been experimenting, like so many musicians had been, with composing for the vernacular rite. We know that come 1553, when the Latin tradition is restored, he is highly fluent in writing Latin polyphony. And this is one of the things for which I think his contemporaries esteemed his style.
So, as you say, Parsons, like Tallis and colleagues in the Chapel Royal, were once again encouraged, maybe even, well, required, I guess, to write Latin music for the restored Catholic tradition when that time came. And you've chosen quite a lengthy piece for us to hear next, I think. Tell us about it. What's its significance?
So, O Bona Jesu is quite an interesting mixture of different sorts of texts, and this may be one of the reasons why it's been quite difficult for musicologists to pin down. As so often in the 16th century, the manuscript sources date from long after the composer died. But there isn't any good reason why this should have been written after Mary Tudor died. It could have been written for use in Catholic worship. We know that the cult of Jesus had been extremely important in the 16th century. It had been promoted actively by the Tudor regime, by the great matriarch of the Tudor dynasty, Margaret Beaufort. And we know that Mary Tudor, Queen Mary, when she came to the throne, was quite keen to promote the cult of Jesus, not least the great confraternity of the Holy Name of Jesus, which met in the shrouds or the crypt of old St. Paul's Cathedral.
Andrew Carwood conducted the Cardinal's music in that Latin motet, O Bone Jesu, by Robert Parsons, perhaps composed during the reign of Queen Mary I, during which she reversed her brother's Protestant reforms in England and reverted to her beloved Catholic traditions. But Mary's reign only lasted 5 years, and after her sister Elizabeth succeeded her in 1558, church musicians had to put aside the old traditions once again in favour of the austere Protestant prayer book of 1552. Now, Magnus, do we know where Parsons' own religious beliefs lay? Which side did he fall onto?
No, I don't think we do. Like almost everyone else in Tudor England, we should probably assume that Robert Parsons did as he was told and conformed. He was, after all, a member of the Chapel Royal. So in October 1563, he's made Epistle Reader, which is the kind of first rung in. And then in January 1564, he's quickly promoted to become a full gentleman of the Chapel Royal. And as such, he is, of course, at the beck and call of the Queen herself. He is in attendance upon her. For this reason, he composes vernacular church music for the prayer book services, alongside music for secular entertainment, instrumental consort music, and probably Latin polyphony for performance in the chamber rather than in church. As far as we can tell from the specks of surviving documentation, Parsons was a typical Elizabethan conformist.
What's the next piece that we're going to hear, Magnus? What should we listen out for?
Well, the next piece is the vernacular anthem, Deliver Me From Mine Enemies. And this anthem spread like wildfire during his lifetime and after, and was his best-known piece right until the Civil War, you know, like 100 years later. And I think one of the reasons, and to be honest, the main reason why this slightly clunky piece proved popular with Tudor and Stuart church musicians was because it's got a canon. We know from his other music, for instance, his big Latin Magnificat, that Parsons absolutely loved writing in canons, as did his younger contemporary William Byrd. And in Deliver Me From Mine Enemies, we can hear a canon at the unison between the top two voices, the two main parts.
Lord, who may dwell in your tabernacle? A setting of Psalm 15, Domine quis habitabit, by Robert Parsons. It was sung there by Contrapunctus, directed by Owen Rees. And before it, you heard an anthem by Parsons, Deliver Me from Mine Enemies, sung by The Cardinals Music, conducted by Andrew Carwood. Now, you've already told us that Parsons became a gentleman of the Chapel Royal 5 years into Elizabeth's reign, in fact. What did that actually mean? What did the title mean for him? Did it give him a better salary, I suppose, and a very busy life?
Yes, Chapel Royal, if you're a gentleman, you will be in regular attendance upon the king or queen when the court is in season. You can do some moonlighting on the side, so you're not necessarily singing for the king or queen every hour of every day. So it gives you a very privileged position. You will be living in or near London. We know, for instance, that Parsons lived in Greenwich from a document, a tax document from 1571. So you may often be performing alongside musicians from the capital. So you get a very advantageous location as well as favourable working conditions. You know, you are working for a discerning patron who encourages the craft of music rather than for, say, a Protestant provincial dean who wants to ensure that the music is kept to a bare minimum. You will also very often be on progress with the king or queen as part of their so-called riding chapel. And even when the court is based in London, it'll be moving from one palace to another. So you'll be singing in a series of slightly different spaces along the Thames Valley. And for this reason, Chapel Royal musicians often take up businesses and become active with property holdings in London and, of course, beyond. And above all, membership of the Chapel Royal makes you a member of the royal household, and this means that there are regular demands to compose and to perform music, not only for performance inside the chapel itself or the various chapel buildings in which you perform, but also for court entertainments and for the secular ceremonial life of the court.
Because the Elizabethan period was a real age when domestic music making was suddenly really blossoming, wasn't it? People were playing at home and viol consorts and all sorts of things to entertain themselves. And I expect they wanted music, good music, to get through and to play. And if it was written by a gentleman of the Chapel Royal, all the better, I guess.
It comes with the Queen's stamp of approval, doesn't it? And, of course, you go to any of the great Elizabethan prodigy houses in the country, and the thing that you most notice about them is the quantity of glass. And that glass gives good light, which improves leisure time. And so the courtly art of music making is both more possible, there's more appetite for it, and it's an effective way to encourage sociability in polite circles. And, of course, Chapel Royal musicians are catering for this culture. They are writing pieces of secular instrumental music. The Chapel Royal is providing entertainments during the great seasons of the 12 days of Christmas and Shrovetide, which are the weeks preceding Lent. Parsons would also have been proficient as an instrumentalist, and we know, for instance, that string playing became a really important part of chorister education in the 1540s, i.e. the very time that Parsons is himself undergoing, presumably, a chorister training.
Thank you.
Man in Nomine by Robert Parsons, played there by the Viols of Hesperion 20, directed by Jordi Savall. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and today I'm exploring the life and music of Robert Parsons in the company of Professor Magnus Williamson of Newcastle University. Magnus, we've just heard a piece that you could say cross the boundaries of church and home music making. And the next piece is rooted completely outside the church altogether, isn't it? It's a song called Pour Down, You Powers Divine. Tell us about it.
Well, this is a fascinating piece. It's the first of a pair of consort songs from a lost choir boy play from the 1560s, the time when Robert Parsons is a member of the Chapel Royal. It's easy to think of the Chapel Royal as being a purely religious body, but members of the Chapel Royal were also really important providers of courtly dramatic entertainments and had been since the 15th century. So it's under Elizabeth that the Chapel Royal Company get their own permanent home at the disused Dominican Friary, Blackfriars, in the 1570s. And this is one of the foundations of modern public theatre and an extremely important forerunner of Shakespeare. And like many early Elizabethan theatre songs, Pour Down Ye Powers Divine is a lament, in this case for a female voice, on behalf of Pandolfo. Pour down ye powers divine on me, poor wretch and silly maid. Some hope, some hap of him, I to have my heart to aid.
Down, You Powers Divine, a consort song from a choir boy play written in the 1560s by Robert Parsons. It was sung there by the countertenor Michael Chance with the viol players of Fretwork. Parsons is now in his early to mid-30s, isn't he, Magnus? We think so anyway. Do we get a sense of how esteemed he was as a composer? Was he very much admired, a bit of a star at this point?
Well, as a member of the Chapel Royal, that's already means that he's made it as a church musician. At a time of shrinking opportunities for church musicians, he has got a safe billet. So these places on the Chapel Royal are hotly competed for. When a member dies, their place is taken very quickly by someone else. We know that he was in good odour with the Queen herself because she grants him leases on Crown property in Lincolnshire, which is often a way to reward members of the Chapel Royal, but wouldn't have been granted to him unless he was in good standing with the Queen. We also know that among his fellow musicians he had a good reputation, or at least he exercised a considerable influence, for instance, over William Byrd. So William Byrd's Great Service, which was written many years later, has as at least one of its models Parsons' First Service, the piece we began with. Parsons' viol consort music clearly blazed a trail, both technically and stylistically.
Galliard for Six Viols by William Byrd, and before it you heard a song called Trumpets by Robert Parsons, who was one of Byrd's early influences. And the performers there were the viol players of the group Phantasm, and not trumpets. Well, we'll hear more about how the Robert Parsons story played out in a few minutes. But first, here's a roundup of this week's early music news.
Thanks, Lucy. Coming up, 17th century graffiti from a mischievous choir boy. But first, a hat trick of Handel. It's hard enough putting on one Handel opera, let alone three productions back to back. This autumn, English touring opera return with Handelfest, a tour of three operas by Handel, travelling to seven different towns and cities across England for 17 shows. I'm part of the orchestra myself and will be playing the rarely performed Ottone, Agrippina, a political satire, and Tamerlano, a tale of love, disguise and vengeance. Here's Robin Norton-Hale, General Director of ETO, to tell us more.
So putting on three operas on a tour that goes all around the country is a massive undertaking. There's really a huge number of people on the road. And the three different operas have three really different sets and aesthetics. And then, of course, we have to turn around in between each night. So when we're somewhere for three nights, we turn up, put up the set, and then after the show, when the audience goes home, then our technicians are working really hard behind the scenes to do a really quick turnaround so that if the audience comes back the next night, they'll have a completely different experience.
English touring opera's Handelfest opened last night in London. Throughout October and November, shows travel to Saffron Walden, Buxton, Poole, Malvern, Truro and Exeter. Speaking of Exeter, inside its magnificent cathedral, a certain young composer channeled his inner graffiti artist there nearly 400 years ago. Behind the cathedral's organ, look closely and you'll see a name carved into the wall, Matthew Locke, 1638. This year marks the 400th anniversary of Matthew Locke's birth, who started his musical career as a chorister at the very place where he etched his name. And next week, the viol consort Fretwork are celebrating this anniversary with an intimate concert, taking Locke's music back to where it all began in Exeter Cathedral on Friday the 7th of October. Matthew Locke, 400 years young. Finally, some early music highlights coming up this week here on Radio 3. Music by Michel Richard de la Londe, recorded at the Early Music Days Festival in Hungary, can be heard throughout the week in afternoon concert. On Fridays in Tune, the vocal group Siglo de Oro will be singing live and talking about their new recording, The Mysterious Motet Book of 1539. And on Record Review, Joseph McCarty recommends his favourite recording of Bach's Matthew Passion. And that's this week's Early Music News with me, Mark Siao.
And there'll be more early music news for you next week. So, Magnus, we have Parsons working for the Chapel Royal in the 1560s, but holding property near Lincoln. And I'm afraid it wasn't very far from there that this story of his comes to a rather untimely end.
Yes, indeed. He ends his life in Newark, drowning in January 1572, according to the checkbook, the so-called checkbook of the Chapel Royal. What was he doing in Newark when he lived in Greenwich and was working in the Chapel Royal? Well, maybe he was visiting Lincolnshire nearby to oversee his leased land, or as plausibly, he was perhaps visiting Newark Parish Church in order to recruit or press gang choristers there for the Chapel Royal. Parsons died intestate and he left a widow, Helen. We don't know if he left any children. His was a life demonstrably brutally cut short, a life of great promise, not entirely yet fulfilled. And we get a sense of this from the Oxford Don Robert Dow, who copied the most beautiful set of part books in the 1580s. And on Robert Parsons, he says, "You, Parsons, who are so great in your springtime, how great you would have been in autumn had death not intervened."
Well, Magnus, thank you so much for guiding us through Parsons' short but very productive life today. And you've chosen arguably his most famous piece to end with.
Yes, who could have a show on Robert Parsons without including the Ave Maria, which is an evergreen in choir repertories and has been in the top 10 ever since it was included in the Oxford Book of Tudor Anthems. We also hear it usually at a rather strange pitch of A major or A flat major, which is where most modern editions have it. But I think it's heard better at its original source pitch of F major equivalent, which is how we hear it here in a splendid recording made by the Cardinal's Music.
The Ave Maria by Robert Parsons, sung there by the Cardinal's Music, conducted by Andrew Carwood. And that ends today's edition of the Early Music Show. It was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Les Pratt. And on next week's show, Hannah French will be marking the 150th anniversary of Vaughan Williams' birth by delving into the composer's interest in Tudor music and celebrating his love of Bach. That's at the usual time, 2 o'clock, next Sunday afternoon. Well, this coming Tuesday here on BBC Radio 3, the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra and its music director Mirga Grajinite-Tilar perform a concert with two sea-inspired masterworks, Debussy's La Mer and Britten's Four Sea Interludes, capturing the spirit of the Suffolk coast in very different moods. The CBSO will be performing Britten's Four Sea Interludes and Debussy's La Mer here on Radio 3 in concert on Tuesday evening from 7:30.
This summer, we've heard some incredible orchestras.
The Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Harding.
Witnessed some phenomenal conductors.
Conducted live here at the BBC Proms by Sir Simon Rattle.
Enjoyed an impressive range of music.
Tonight we celebrate the undisputed Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin.
And gloried in the power of the human voice. Relive the prom season on BBC Sounds. Available until mid-October, just search for proms.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 3 o'clock and it's time now for Choral Evensong, which was first broadcast live on Wednesday from the chapel of the Old Royal Naval College, Greenwich, in London, on the eve of the Feast of Michael and All Angels. The canticles are sung to the set in B-flat by John Stainer, and the anthem is a setting by William Harris of words by the 16th century poet Edmund Spenser. Fair is the heaven where happy souls have place in full enjoyment of felicity. The service opens now with an introit by Richard Dering. Factum est silentium. There was silence in heaven as the dragon joined battle with the Archangel Michael.